What's Apache Druid, and what does it have to do with Apache Kafka? Rachel Podreski, a longtime analytics expert, technical pre-sales leader, and community advocate, is going to tell us on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Welcome back to another episode of Streaming Audio. I am your host, Tim Berglund, and I'm joined in the virtual studio today by a very good friend of mine, first-time guest on this program, Rachel Podreski. Rachel, welcome to Streaming Audio.
Thank you very, very much, Tim. It is an honor to be here.
It is great to have you. Why don't you tell us who you are, why you are on this show, and why you would say things that are of interest to our audience.
That's an interesting way of putting it.
I want to put you on the spot, you know, like you have to demonstrate they're listening now. You know, this is going to be a good 45 minutes long. Why do they want to commit to this? You got to tell them.
Well, I think they should commit to it because you and I have some really epic banter that at least amuses the two of us. It might be some other human.
My priority, yeah.
Right. So I think that's why I'm on the show. Whether or not I have anything relevant to say, well, I guess we'll find out at the end of the 45 minutes.
I guarantee you do. Where do you work and what is your role there? How's that?
That's how it works. Okay, I work for a Confluent partner called Imply Data. We are the company behind the Apache Druid project. And what do I do there? Well, it's a startup, so I do a lot of things. But officially, my job is to run the worldwide field engineering organization, which in other names is also sales engineering, solutions engineering, pre-sales consulting. We've got so many names.
Yeah, and you are, to paraphrase Sheriff Behan from Tombstone, a woman of many parts, but I think sales engineering is one of the, like, the defining things of your career. And everybody, sales engineering is what pre-sales technical people call themselves. You know, they're the partner to the salesperson proper who actually helps make the technology work and answer technology questions. We've talked to SEs. Sometimes we call them systems engineers. There have been SEs on this program before. I want to say most recently, Danny Traphagen.
That's an SE that I might know. I might know that.
That is actually, it happens to be a mutual acquaintance of the two of us. So anyway, yeah, you lead the organization of the technical people that partner with the salespeople to help customers when they're trying to buy stuff from your company, right?
That is very true. I think a SE job is the best job in software because we get all the best portions of a customer. Like, we get them when they're happy and they're excited about the technology. And that's our job, is to get them excited about it and help them figure out if it makes sense in their infrastructure. And we don't have to be like that salesperson who, you know, asks them if they need to get into newer used software today. Like, it's a very cool job to have. And I've been doing it for the most part of 20 years. Yes.
Some number of years.
Of years. Which
we could probably estimate by judicious Googling, but we won't. Some amount of time, and you're pretty good at it at this point. And yeah, it is interesting point about kind of being on the front end of, you know, timeline wise of the relationship where you're figuring out what can be and what can be done, as opposed to, say, post sales support or consulting or delivery of those things when you're more finding where bodies are buried and where things are difficult and all that sort of business.
Yeah, I call that working for a living. And yeah, pre-sales is not working for a living.
Pre-sales is, I think it's a very hard job. You have to have a unique skill set of really having some capability as a salesperson and all of the, you know, sort of political savvy and communication skill that comes with that. But you have to be deeply technical. So you remind me of years ago in my independent consulting that period of my professional life, I was always on that same side of things. Hey, let me help you get this planned out. Let's sketch out some architecture, spike a prototype, get your team trained, and peace out. I'm gone. And then, you know, everybody else writes the code and figures out where the difficult things are. So there you go. Now there's more to what you do. I want to get into that later. There's a lot of the kind of community aspects of what you do, I think, which is where you've also been a leader in your career. And I want to talk about that, but you mentioned some technologies, and this is a show about Kafka, Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud, which I said went during the opener.
Is the cloud a thing? I wasn't aware.
100%.
Oh, wow.
Actually, if you'd like some free industry analysis from me, everybody, I think the cloud is going to be big. I heard it here first. So the cloud's a thing. Kafka's a thing, definitely. Confluent Cloud's a thing. We talk about that. Confluent Platform, all these kind of streaming technologies. Druid is, properly speaking, not one of those. And you said that you're on this show because you're a Confluent partner. You're not just on the show because you're a Confluent partner. This is not everybody behind the scenes. This is not our mutual business development teams pulling the strings and you know, trading favors to get Rachel on the show. I actually think it's an interesting topic, and it's a topic that you kind of go deep in from a technology standpoint, but I'd like you to tell us what Druid is. I kind of want to just talk about that for a little while.
Oh, what Druid is. Well, let's start with Druid is a database. And that means a lot of things to a lot of people. So it's a very kind of almost controversial thing to say, because we can say, what is a database? You know that. But at the end of the day, Druid is a place where you put data and then you take data out of it to do something with it.
Is that, by the way, I have a talk that I've been giving for the last year or so that I start by asking the question, what is a database? And it's kind of like the undergraduate philosophy, what is a chair question? And you're like, well, I know what a chair is. And then you actually try to answer the question. You realize you don't know anything. So is that your definition of a database, that thing you just said? Place where you put data and then get it back later?
Where you store data for a period of time, and then you take some of that data out at some point to do something with it. But it pretty much stays there. Yeah, I don't know if I have a personal definition of a database. I mean, that might be a flaw in my brand. I might need to have done that in my life to define.
I'm just here to help you grow.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
So I interrupted you. Druid is a database.
Yeah. And so we'll go back, you know, in time a little bit. And I started my career with also a database company called Redbrick. And Redbrick was a database that was specifically designed for data warehousing. And it was started by a gentleman named Ralph Kimball, who, if you are a data warehousing person, you might have heard of.
You might have heard of that name.
Yes. And I remember my interview for that job. So I was fresh out of college, didn't really know anything about databases. And I was looking in the appendix of a database book on what an index was in order to answer that question during my interview. So I really didn't know anything about databases. My mathematics degree from University of California, Santa Cruz did not prepare me for what is a D3 index question.
No, it just didn't.
No. But I started my career with thinking about databases in the terms of analytics and not in the terms of what I learned later was third normal form or OLTP systems. And Redbrick was really cool. It was ended up being purchased by another database company called Informix. And Informix eventually got purchased by a company you might have heard of called IBM.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So, it's interesting. We look forward to what Druid is, and it's almost like it's the next generation or the third generation or ninth generation or something. It is the great great grandchild of technologies like Redbrick, and so it's a database that's for analytics versus a database that is primary for transactions, except that those worlds have sort of merged together. And if you saw my Kafka Summit slides, and I'll put in a plug for my Kafka Summit San Francisco 2019 slides. I have this picture of there's OLAP technologies or online analytical processing technologies, and there's OLTP technologies, and they've all sort of merged now into what I just call P, processing. That whole line between what's OLTP and what's OLAP is really blurred.
Could you, real quick, for the new folks in the back row, define those two things, OLTP and OLAP?
Sure. OLTP, online transaction processing. It is, if you think of the grocery store analogy, when you go through a grocery store in the United States, you you have your things and they get scanned. And every time it gets scanned, it is updating some database somewhere with inventory information. It's a very quick transaction. Oh, Rachel bought chicken nuggets, right? Okay, so let's update that. Actually, not Rachel brought it, chicken nuggets, more importantly. Chicken nuggets were purchased. Let's take one of those off of our inventory. And then it also creates like a register of the things that I bought as well, so I can get a total at the end. And I consider that OLTP. Those are very short little transactions that keep track of what's going on.
And they reflect things that happened in the world. They correspond to events in the world.
Yeah. And there's, you know, we could even talk about ACID here, and we could talk about all these interesting technological ins and outs. But for the most part, they're short requests. And I think that is a term that I sold from DBMS to short request. And OLAP is the idea that you gather all that information and you can ask it questions. So now you can say, all right, what are mothers of two young children buying at grocery stores on Friday nights? Ah, chicken nuggets. I'm sure that was an analysis somebody did at some point. It's about more long request processing. So asking questions over larger pieces of data to get insights. And I think if you're old like some of us are and remember when they started offering loyalty cards at grocery stores.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's when people try to figure out, oh yeah, we've got some good data here. We should like do something with it. And let's try to track who the person is with what they're buying so we can market to them better and we can market to the group better. And that's, at least in my grocery store analogy, how I define the difference between OLTP and OLAP.
Very nice. Because those are probably everybody listening. Well, I'm gonna go with everyone listening to this knows what a database is. Everyone listening to this is probably broadly familiar with the idea of analytics. But there has been historically a sharp distinction between those two kinds of databases. And that's for you know, highly implementation-specific technology reasons. They're very different kinds of ways of accessing data. You know, one prioritizes writing and a certain kind of retrieval that is of small amounts of data and has to move fast. And the other one, analytics prioritizes kind of looking at all the things. You don't look at all the things when you're doing OLTP, when you're doing transactions. When you're doing analytics, you kind of do. It's this big bucket of stuff and you look at all of them. And it's for good, reasonable implementation reasons, it's just hard to build one thing that does them both. And so that's those terms. And it's funny that you say that they're blending, because it just seems like I don't hear those words, those acronyms as much as I used to. And I don't know if they're falling out of favor or what's happening. They're still totally valid categories. And I wanted to make sure everybody knew.
I think that's part of where you work. I mean, I would say that Kafka is one of the technologies that is blurring the lines between the two. And there's a chicken and egg analogy here that we can say, right? Is it because the industry is moving towards no longer that distinction that Kafka emerged, you know, from the brains of smart people? Or is it the other way around? Is it because technologies like Kafka have been enabling democratization of this ETL process and the democratization and the ability to do polyglot persistence in a meaningful and real way? That, you know, there's a question for you.
Yeah, it's kind of the great man versus the zeitgeist theory of software or great project? You know, is it sort of a trend that's happening? And if there's a very influential technology that emerges, it's a part of that trend, or is the technology emerges and causes the trend? And that's a topic for another podcast, but I see where you're going with that. I definitely, Kafka broadly is certainly trying to be a part of that blending.
Well, and that's exactly the reason why Druid exists, because the type of applications that Kafka allows for, this kind of idea of data that is streaming from wherever all the time, the applications that you build on it are no longer just set to be those transaction processing, but you now can do more of these long requests, these, you know, looking at all the data type of applications in real time and look at historical data. And that didn't used to be available because ETL made things long. I met a C-level executive at Disney last year, and I was trying to explain what we did, and I mentioned ETL at some point. And he's like, oh, I know what ETL is. Like, his eyes got all bright. He goes, those are the things that make my reports slow. And I'm like, well, yeah. I mean, at one point, Gartner was saying that ETL took 18 to 24 months to create an enterprise data warehouse. And when I built one for Vail Resorts, it took me like 10 months just to do it, you know, for a very small data set. So that world of batch and the world of, hey, or even micro batch for that, it is no longer relevant. People want to have data-driven applications at their fingertips, and they want to have conversations with the data, but they need to see the data as it's happening, not what it happened 5 minutes ago. I mean, Druid came from the world of digital marketing, where presenting the most appropriate advertisement is going to get you more money at the end of the day. So it's like the ultimate of taking OLTP and OLAP and smashing them together and say, here, go figure that out. And that's where Druid came from.
And by the way, we'll link in the show notes to a recent interview with Stuart Bryson, who talked all that stuff Rachel just said. He and I dove deeply. That question in particular, like, what is driving the move from traditional ETL to streaming? You know, we talked about, took apart the idea of what is traditional ETL and how does streaming differ. And some of that, he actually had some surprising conclusions that had come from his practice. So check that episode out if you haven't listened already. That's a good way to get more into that. But it sounds like Druid is a database. Druid is an analytics database. Druid is an analytics database that expects to be answering questions in real time. I'm going to use that highly inflammatory word and let you back off of it. Am I putting words in your mouth? Is this good?
No, I'm glad that all my words got so succinctly summarized.
It is my one job on this program.
Excellent. Thank you.
So tell us a little bit more. It's a real-time analytics database. Yeah. What makes an analytics database an analytics database? Tell us about the tech a little bit.
Yeah, it's actually extremely cool. And it takes ideas that are not like that far out. They're actually things that other technologies have done over the years. They've just not quite put them together this way, and, you know, added a little sprinkling of magic druid dust on top of it to make it even more like unicorn magical. But for the most part, we're looking at ideas like real-time ingest. So search systems are really good at that, enabling technologies like Kafka and other streaming technologies. Those provide this real-time ingest. So that was a number one requirement when they were building out Druid. So data needed to be fresh. It also needed to be schema flexible. This was data changes slowly. I used to do talks on slowly changing dimensions, you know, type one, type two, type three.
Good traditional data warehouse stuff.
Yeah. But data changes, and the types of dimensions that you're going to want to query on is not always you know, exactly what you decided at the beginning. So this idea that schema on write that traditional data warehouses implemented needed to be loosened up a little bit, but maybe not as loose as it happens in a data lake with Hadoops, because then you end up with, I don't know, maybe a mess, maybe a swamp, maybe not really knowing what data belongs where. So Drew definitely has a concept of a schema flexible design. It also aggregates data upon ingest, kind of as you want it to be aggregated. So there's a lot of data that's out there at the millisecond level. And honestly, most humans don't really care about data at the millisecond level. We might care about it at the second level or the minute level. So you can set Druid to ingest and aggregate data appropriately at that time. Also, it stores it in a columnar sense. So you can add new columns. It's super easy. It's no longer the days of alter table, add column, wait 15 years, your database goes down, people yell at you. Just add a new column. And those columns are by default indexed and compressed. So we typically say that your raw data to data in Druid is about 10 to 1. So you'll get about 10 to 1 compression within Druid. Yeah. So it means you can save more data for longer. It's also a post-cloud database, because we already established earlier today that, you know, the cloud is a thing. Druid was developed after the cloud became a thing, which was not just a few minutes ago, but probably a while ago. And has been designed to minimize the your compute costs. So you can move different types of processing threads to different types of machines to, you know, get a better cost performance ratio there.
Got it. Got it. Okay. So just designed to be cost efficient with compute resources in the cloud.
Totally. And then also tier off data too. So you can put, you know, 5-year-old data on maybe sort of S3 style storage, while you might put last month's data more in RAM. Tiered data at ingest is
tiered storage is baked in.
Yep.
Excellent. Exactly. Excellent. That is I appreciate that you see post cloud and not cloud native. I mean, I'm not above saying cloud native. It does mean something. It is a meaningful term with specific semantic content associated with it. But you do kind of have to back off and say what you mean, because it does get abused. And post cloud, I think, is more specific, and I think drives your point there. You said columnar in storage. For anyone who does not know what a columnar database is, what does that even mean?
The data is stored in columns versus rows. So at the end of the day, everything's always just going to be files. It's just real talk, you know, it's all files. Excuse me. Each column is stored as a set of files. And therefore, when you query your data, you are only going to be opening up the files of the columns that you need, and therefore more efficient, blah, 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 blah. So columnar databases are not new. They've been around for a while. I worked for a company called Vertica that is a columnar database, and there's others out there. So that was one of the OLAP-y features that the authors of Druid picked up, was columnar databases make for much faster table scans, to put in lack of a better term.
Let me throw a scenario at you, which I believe to be true. Again, if this idea of a columnar database is a new thing to you, this is for your benefit. But let me try to summarize this, and you tell me if I'm right. So the typical OLTP query is to, on write, create a new row or modify one row somewhere, usually, right? So you have a file or a set of files, and you have some index that tells you where's the offset in the file of the block of data that has that row, and you go read that offset, and you change the thing, and you write it back, or you go put a new one in a free block, and you write it in there, something like that, right? The OLTP is all about inserting a row, changing a row. Or when you read, you just read probably a row. OLAP, or analytics, generally, like I said before, you're reading all the things. You want to read all the things and do some sort of reducing operation to those things, like say add them or average them or find the biggest, or of course there are more sophisticated things, but let's just stick with those. And maybe I want to go through some time range of rows. And it's a lot less efficient to have to do that on a row by row basis with an OLTP style storage format, because you got all this IO you have to do, where if you're really just aggregating one column or a small number of columns, this file with columns in it, and now I can index into that and seek to the place in the file where my time range or whatever starts. And I can now do this big sequential read of the day or the year or whatever it is. And it's all there in this file sequentially. And I do my aggregation. Is that right?
Sounds good to me. I always love hearing you describe these things because you do them so well. And I go, oh, wow. I need to steal all of that for my
This is box. Sort of by definition being recorded. So we can get you a transcript.
Excellent.
Yeah. So, and that's, again, if databases are not your world, then, you know, you can hear things like OLTP, OLAP, columnar, and they just mean nothing. Or if you're relatively new to the business, this just might be things you don't know yet. So Druid is one of those. And obviously there's lots and lots of ways to be a columnar database, and it is kind of optimized for this life in the cloud. I have another question. I feel like I'm moving you on and you had something else to say. Are you?
No,
I'm
much more happy to answer questions.
All right, good, good. Just making sure. What does this have to do with Kafka? So Druid's cool, and I kind of wanted people to just be able to learn a little bit about it. Here's another Apache open source project. It's kind of a brother or sister to Kafka. Why are these things discovered in the wild together?
Because Druid is really, really, really good at taking data from Kafka and ingesting it. And in my world of pre-sales and helping customers get up and running with Druid and with the Imply stack, I so prefer it if they're using Kafka, because boy, it makes my life easy. Like the integrations just works extremely well. So we can get you can get queries coming off of your Kafka data, in a matter of minutes. And that's a real game changer from the world that I used to work in, where when you had a new data set, it may take weeks or if not months in order to be able to get to the point where you can query it. So one of the reasons that you see these things in the wild is that Druid works really well as Kafka as an ingest, to the point where there is a mutual, customer or user of both Kafka and Druid. And they're a pretty prominent tech company. And they actually told me they brought in Kafka because they were using Druid, because they wanted to be able to stream data in real time, and Druid's integration with Kafka was so good that they started using Kafka, and then it just went, viral within their organization.
Nice.
As it does.
Very nice. And we'd say who that customer is, but two things. Number one, if they're referenceable for you, because you're in pre-sales and you pre-sales people always know that. I am in developer relations. I never know, Rachel, off the top of my head, whether a given customer is referenceable or not. We didn't coordinate this before the show, so we just can't say the name. Maybe if we figure out later, we can. We'll put it in the show notes, and you can know, hey, here's this customer who's a super compelling user of both. And you can look at what
they're not. I don't think they're a customer of ours.
They're just open source users.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. And I want to come back to that, in a minute, but that makes sense. It is real time, and I'll say, I always feel like a little piece of me dies when I say real time in this sense. But this real time analytics cloud, post cloud database, and by real time we mean you're not going to be waiting for long, right? The idea is you ingest data, it is rapidly indexed, and will be available for queries sooner than the technology it's replacing. Is kind of what real time tends to mean. It has a It is an imprecise term, but it gets the idea across. And that's Druid. And so people who are dealing with evented data, they may make a commitment to Druid and say, hey, we need Kafka for ingest, or people who are using Kafka for integration, between microservices or ingest of events, or just kind of building event-driven systems in general, if they've embraced that architectural paradigm, you want to answer questions about your data. And obviously Kafka and Confluent, you know, we have a story. We've got Kafka Streams, and Confluent has KSQL, and these are all these real-time analytics things, or at least tools with which you can build software that does evented analysis, you know, real-time analytics computations. But those are, we'll say, highly purpose-built analytics queries. A KSQL job that's running is something that has been operationalized, right? You know what that query is, and you just want that query running all the time. If you want to have a bunch of data in Kafka topics and then go do exploration or exploratory analytics on it, that's not going to work real well. That's just not a real Kafka use case just yet. And so when you have this Kafka Druid combination, that vastly broadens the horizon of the kinds of analytics work you can do. You can do, it seems like in Druid, you could do, people do operational stuff, right? People build a dashboard that somebody is expecting to use, and they put that in front of Druid, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, alerting capabilities, et cetera.
Totally, totally. And then if you want, because the capability I'm always talking about how to enable is the exploratory data science thing. You know, how do I give something to someone to play with? And, you know, business stakeholders ask crazy questions about, hey, you know, is it more likely if for this person, you know, accounts convert at a higher probability in Q3 if I know the internal champion has a turtle for a pet or something, you know, whatever. That'll, you know, some business analyst will come to a data science team with a question like that. And you probably didn't have a KSQL query that was answering that. You know, you need data sitting somewhere to be able to ask it.
Well, there's very few universal truths in this world. And I do think that one of the universal truths I have is that no matter how much talking to your users you do about what reports they need, they're always going to lie to you. They're always going to want something more. So as soon as you give them something, you say, yes, this is everything you wanted. They go, yes, this is great. And 3 minutes later, they're like, but what about this? And that is exactly the type of use cases that you're going to want a database like Druid for. And it's just like, here, have fun. Go have fun with the data. I'm just going to step out of this situation now.
Exactly. That makes a lot of sense. Now, turning the page, I want to talk about something else. You and I have worked together in the past. And I think we said that before, right? I don't know if we did. Rachel and I have been coworkers in the past at the same company. It's been delightful. I will say once and future coworkers. We have worked together on community efforts. Of course, that's what I do. I run developer relations here at Confluent. You're in sales engineering, but you've got some thoughts about community that honestly have been helpful to me as I form my sort of developer relations worldview and ideas about strategy. And you've got some thoughts on how it integrates with sales engineering, since that's, you know, I think the better part of your heart is being an SE leader, but there's also this sort of inner community leader, Rachel, that seems like she's struggling to break out sometimes. So just tell us your thoughts.
Well, I think it's more because of honestly, the two roles are really, really similar now.
Yeah, especially tell me about
that. An open source company. Yeah. It's something I spend a lot of time thinking about because I've spent my career working for both companies that are open core. So they have an open source project that they provide support services and other software around. And I've also worked for completely closed source companies. And in pre-sales, you get your whole life is pretty much helping people through a POC or trying to avoid POCs where possible, because POCs are work. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, SEs, you know, we leave the hard stuff like down the line, right? So these proof of concepts is what I mean by a POC. And when you work for an open source company, or when you do, when you have an open core product, a lot of the POCs are done without you knowing about it. And can I tell a little story, Tim?
Yeah, you can. I want to hear this.
That has to do with airplanes and, you know, mathematicians.
Rachel, will you tell me a story?
Okay, great. Yeah, so there is this great book that I read a few years back about how to make decisions using mathematical logic. And it's in the show notes. I added that to the document earlier. And in the prologue, of all places, they tell this great story about a Austrian-born mathematician named Abraham Wald, who helped the U.S. military during World War II. And one of the questions that the military had asked Mr. Wald was, hey, we're getting all these planes back from the European theater, and there are bullet holes all over the fuselage. And we're always wondering, you know, armoring the planes is expensive and it makes it heavy. So can you look at all where all the bullet holes are and figure out where we should put the armor? And in the wise mind of Austrian-born mathematicians, he said, well, probably we should look at the planes that are at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean rather than the ones that came back. And what they found was that the holes that weren't were in the engines, because those planes didn't make it back. And I think about open source proof of concepts like that. And I even, to the point where internally, I always talk about the planes at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. Where are the POCs that we're losing that we don't know about? You know, where do people struggle with Druid in open source and then abandon it? Or where does Druid not show up as a possible solution to a problem when it could be, because the right blog posts aren't out there, or the right.
Right. So instead of planes come back with holes in them and we add armor there to the holes, and, you know, actually planes perform worse with that armor. You know, you got to look for the planes. Where did they get hit that prevented them from coming back? And so the analogy is all of your, you know, closed lost analysis on POCs is not exactly what you don't want, but one of the things you don't want. That's potentially deceptive.
Exactly. And when you're looking at your incoming prospects, and if they have had a successful experience in the community with their proof of concept, the SE has a lot less to do. Right, they're going to have to build the value around the services, and in my case, that Imply provides, versus spending time getting Druid up and running. So it lowers the total cost of sale. So investing in community is actually lowers the total cost of sale for a software company. And so this is where I've been looking at for the last, oh God, 5, 6, 7 years now, because it's so important that you have a strong, vibrant community that are bringing you customers that have been successful. And I like to talk, and so we hear a lot about, you know, community is the top of the funnel, the marketing funnel. And yeah, it may be if you're looking at it from the perspective of a software company. But if you're looking at it the perspective kind of at the higher level, community is really your flywheel. The more energy you have in your community to move that wheel, the more people are going to move it for you, and the more people are going to be successful with your project, and that will cause more people to be successful with your project, and therefore it's going to trickle down into the experience that they have with the company that's behind the project as well. So my idea around community is that it has to delight the user from every moment, because community is what the user is going to see throughout their entire life with not just the project, but also with your company, hopefully.
I like it. So how can community delight those users? What needs to be present in your view?
Oh, and that's a big question, right?
There's a whole other, I ask you at 40 minutes into the podcast, you know.
Right. Well, that I think a lot of that is not, there's no playbook for it yet. It's almost like when you do demand gen marketing for software, there's a fairly defined playbook. Like you do X, Y, Z, you're going to get these types of results, you know, money in, money out. And I think in community, we don't have a playbook because every community is going to be different. And you're going to, and every community is in a different stage of their flywheel development. It's almost like you have to continuously adapt your community program in order to reflect the way your community looks at that particular moment. You know, I'm a big proponent of doing surveys. And so if you do see a survey from the Druid community coming out, it's 100% because we want to make the community better for the users and attract more users. So I think asking a lot of questions and trying to figure out, at least for me, who is the ideal community person? Like, who is going to be the user of Druid at the end of the day? Who's going to be making those decisions and who's going to be influential in there? And they're not easy questions to answer.
No, indeed. And you said flywheel a couple times, and I would like to ask you to expand on it because this is just one of the most insightful things about community that I've ever heard you say. And for the benefit of the listening audience, I have heard Rachel say this before, very influential concept. What do you mean by flywheel, and flywheel in contrast to what? Talk us through that.
Yeah. So flywheel, and to me, in contrast to that top of the funnel that I mentioned earlier. And so a flywheel overcomes inertia. And I think there's a tendency for communities, as anything, to fall into inertia if they're not, if they're not pushed in some way. And a community as a flywheel, you know, helps a group overcome inertia. And then the more power that you put behind it, the more effective that community gets. And that's what I'm saying is, if we think about our community organizations in terms of the power that fuels the organization versus a place that we get leads, we're going to end up creating a more delightful experience throughout the customer's entire journey with the project and with the company.
There you go. And where I have taken this, by the way, which again, just amazingly insightful analogy, where I've taken it is to measurement. With a funnel, you know, I have not spent a career as a marketing professional. I've just really in the last few years been close enough to, you know, some really, I would say, highly scientific marketing operations to appreciate just how dang quantitative it is and how mechanical it is. Most of my fellow engineers, when they think of marketing, they think of, you know, this big party with a 2-drink minimum and a bunch of people who don't work, or maybe they make big logos or something like that. You know, it's they think of, I'll say with respect
to... logos are important. I like logos.
They are, but with respect to my colleagues in corporate marketing, they think of 2-drink minimums are good too. They think of like the worst stereotype of corporate marketing is just, you know, fluff and pump and blah, 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 you know. But marketing is this incredible mechanistic thing where you are identifying people and you are communicating with them and measuring when they go away or what it takes to optimize the probability with which they will convert to being somebody who pays you money. And it's all like science. It's amazing, the machines these people build. So I think there's a lot of my fellow engineers don't appreciate how much what a quantitative game that is.
And dude, marketing is hard.
Right. And if you do that with, if you take that game over to community, okay, we've got people coming to meetups. Let's sign them up. Let's get them on a drip campaign, send them an email with some helpful content. and you know, click here for to download the white paper and all that kind of stuff. They'll never come to your meetup again, and they'll tweet about you, right? That doesn't work. So you can't apply that funnel discipline to community, because I think we, and by when I say we, I mean technical people, expect when we access community resources, like a meetup, like a conference talk, like a tutorial video or blog post, you don't want to sign up for that. You know, you don't want a salesperson to call you. You don't have budget anyway. Like, don't bother me. I'm just trying to learn here. And so the question becomes, like, everybody knows how to measure a funnel. And that's this whole discipline. And that's, you know, that side of marketing and growth. And it's a science, and it's cool. But you go over to community, and Rachel's funnel analogy, or pardon me, flywheel analogy. You don't collect names. You don't measure when they drop off. What you do is you measure how much energy is in the flywheel, right? How fast is it spinning? How much mass is in it, and how fast is it going? And more specifically, what that means is you can count activities in the community. How many uniques does the blog post get? Does the video tutorial get? How many people are at your meetups? How many are RSVPing? How many meetups do you have? Et cetera, you know, whatever it is that you're doing to nurture your particular community, measuring the energy in the flywheel is sufficient. Because, well, it's not just sufficient. It's that you can't measure it like a funnel, because it'll go away. If you think of it like a flywheel and measure it like a flywheel, then you're still able to nurture it if you have some skilled community leadership behind the rudder there.
Word. That was awesome.
Okay. Well, that's, and I can only say those words because this was like, I don't know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we had some conversation on the phone. I don't remember exactly what the context was, but you're like, think of it like a flywheel. And there was the mind blown GIF sort of appearing over my head. And it was just very helpful. So that's Rachel Podreski, words of Tim Berglund, ideas of Rachel Podreski. It's a funnel.
Sometimes they're better than the cloud has become a thing.
Not untrue. Any other thoughts on community? I kind of took over there for you there for a minute, but I just get excited about this idea.
Oh, I have so many thoughts on community, but I, you know, probably need to save it for a conversation for another time. If I leave anything, it's that the, you know, treat your sales engineers as evangelists, because they're going to be the best ones out there. And there is no better outcome from a first call than to have the person that you're going to be meeting with say, oh, that's right, I saw that person's video on that particular topic. Talk about creating, you know, technical credibility right away. So there's lots and lots of good reasons that sales engineering and community should be friends. we should rethink maybe how we talk about those two organizations.
My guest today has been Rachel Podreski. Rachel, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
And thank you, Tim. I enjoyed my time, and let's go out there and community some.
And there you have it. Before I go, I want to tell you that we have a pretty cool new offer to help you get started with Confluent Cloud without you having to pay for anything. If you're a new user and you go through the regular signup process and start using Confluent Cloud, your first $50 of usage per month are free. This will last for the first 3 months after you sign up. So that's $50 per month of serverless Kafka for 3 months at no cost to you. So go to the sign up link in the show notes. I don't want to read you the URL, and sign up now. I think the only thing I could really do more is write your code for you. And I think we can both agree that's too much to ask. So check it out and hey, let us know how you like it. Anyway, as always, I hope this podcast was helpful to you. If you want to discuss it or ask a question, you can reach out to us on Twitter at Confluent Inc. or reach out to me at TL Berglund. That's TLBERGLUND. Or you can hit us up in Community Slack. There's a sign-up link for that in the show notes as well. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through iTunes, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover the podcast, which is a good thing. Thanks a lot for your support, and we'll see you next time.